Unfortunately, Dr. Ryan, Paul, money drives this country, and as much as I know that you hate it, it's going to be driving this movement also. And
understood.
I think, unfortunately, you and I are not going to be able to do much about it. We're going to go for the ride, and we're going to try to find ways to, you know, work with it the best that we can. I think a big part of it is that we're too top-heavy.
Behavioral Health Integrations Podcast strives to inspire the next generation of mental health and addiction specialists. Our aim is to continue to raise awareness and encourage collaboration in the mental health and addiction industry so that it will continue to thrive. There are numerous approaches to treating mental health and substance abuse issues. On this show, we take pleasure in showcasing the diversity of these approaches used to improve the lives of others. So without further ado, your host, Jacob Minnig.
What is up, everyone? This is Jacob Minnig, host of the Behavioral Health Integration Podcast. Today, I have guests Jordan, Dr. Ryan Paul, Dr. Sophia, Dr. Fisher. It's an honor and pleasure to be here with you.
Thanks so much.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning. It's great to be here.
Hi, Jacob. Good to see everybody.
But yeah, I'm so excited to be here with everyone. I know we're going to have a lot of fun. We're going to have a fun educational ride, just discussing the combination of ketamine-assisted therapy, psychedelic-assisted therapy. And I have some ideas that I want to discuss as well as you do. And again, like I said, I'm very excited to have you all here on the show.
Thanks again.
So just right off the bat, I'm always a huge fan of like integration. And I guess my original idea based on all of this was how we as a society and as a business model actually combined, let's say, again, ketamine treatment with psychedelic assisted therapy. For example, let's say we have the ketamine side and a client or a patient would go through that process. Let's say after 7 to 8 weeks, not get like the beneficial effects. How would you again make that transition to ketamine assisted therapy to psychedelics? Again, assuming that your medical facility has like psilocybin, MDMA, LSD, how would we again make that transition for the patient if they were going to switch over to another treatment that might be more beneficial to them?
Because in a lot of the states where ketamine is really popular are the states where other psychedelics are not quite legal yet. What I will tell some people is similar to how there is a genetic test for kind of finding out if you have specific antidepressants that might work better. There is actually a genetic test to help people identify what psychedelic they'll be best responding to. So I'll sometimes refer people out to that. But a lot of times during the assessment, I'm also assessing, as a therapist, I'm not making recommendations based on medication, like in the neurotransmitters and that sort of thing, but kind of the culture around each of these medicines. I think ketamine can be a little bit more medicalized. It doesn't have to be, but it has its roots in traditional Western medicine. Some people are looking for something a little bit more spiritual, and I might point them towards ayahuasca or a psilocybin retreat.
Jordan, that's so interesting that I actually hadn't heard of the testing. I'm really curious about how can I find out more information about that?
Oh, gosh, I will have to do some digging. I can pass that information along to Jacob. I'm blanking on the name of it, but it's like the same sort of thing. You swab your cheek, send it into, you know, some mail-in site. And I had a few people who've done it before.
Mm-hmm. Did they find it helpful?
As helpful as these tests can be. I mean, I think there's a lot that goes into it beyond one's biology, right? But for some people, that's kind of what they need to feel a little bit more confident in the work that they're going to be doing.
Makes sense. Mm-hmm. I used to practice a lot of medication management, and I do sometimes these tests, and I've got back all these results and trying to interpret, okay, is this something that's going to be helpful? And I'm always interested in additional avenues of if more information.
Yeah,
and I think that we have a long way to go as it relates to pharmacogenomics, right? And we are really kind of getting to that place where that's something that's being mainstream deployed. So some of the difficulty is obviously we've struggled for like the last, really, I guess it's 30, 40 years now of introducing psychopharmacology and believing that that was going to ultimately be the solution, and finding out in the early 2000s that we were going to then have to figure out how these drugs were going to be introduced beyond just the experimentation of throwing opportunity at the barn wall with our patients. And so I think that, if pharmacogenomics in and of itself has really opened up the door for things like pain management, chronic and rare disease, and we're able to go down, we're able to kind of go down a trail where we can be more effective in psychopharmacology, I think that the next bastion of opportunity as it relates to these type of testing opportunities does kind of fit in the scope of mental and behavioral health beyond, right, primary mental health and psychopharmacology as we see it traditionally. But I think that we are a ways off from those things really being effective. I think that they're informative, right? And I think that, you know, as Jordan said, there's this opportunity for confidence to be drawn from it so that people will go down that road. But as I always say, it's not what works, it's what someone will commit to that will work, kind of gets them to the place. And so some of these things, some of these opportunities with pharmacogenomics are opening up the door to at least making a more convincing argument or a third party argument, unfortunately, on behalf of a prescriber to a patient to get them to be compliant with their medication. And that's something that we do in, you know, something that we do in our practice on a daily basis is medication therapy management, drug counseling, and just trying to make sure that large populations are adherent in any particular therapy at any given time. So I think that there's a ways to go, but I think it's exciting about what that might look like in the next 10 years.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and I'm just always interested to just how insurances are gonna take these therapeutic modalities, how we're gonna get reimbursed. Because again, I know that plays a huge role in, again, like the services that we apply.
Yeah, and something that's really exciting since the last time that I believe we chatted is that there has been, the AMA did approve
Behavioral Health Integrations Podcast therapy, strives to inspire the next generation of mental health and addiction specialists. Our aim is to continue to raise awareness and encourage collaboration in the mental health and addiction industry so that it will continue to thrive. There are numerous approaches to treating mental health and substance abuse issues. On this show, we take pleasure in showcasing the diversity of these approaches used to improve the lives of others. So without further ado, your host, Jacob Minig.
In terms of which provider gets to actually bill that, we still have more information to find out.
Yeah, so I think that when it comes to the managed care world, you have your biggest offenders, Blues, United, Cigna, and Humana. And if the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association is able to build that into both a fee-for-service and a value-based program for MSO, ACO type of models, within regional HMOs, whether it be serving a Medicare population, a Medicaid population, or a commercial plans in the middle, the biggest issue is going to be is it going to be fee for service? I think the difficulty is going to be how are we treating outpatient versus at home, and ultimately things like what's the role of the pharmacist, right, in this, which is a big thing. I actually just wrote a white paper about kind of reducing the taboo of how we introduce reimbursement for psilocybin and MDMA specifically in the U.S. healthcare system. And we have a long way to go. I mean, you mentioned synthetic psilocybin before you got on. I was kind of sounding off about the fact that personally, I just have an issue with that in and of itself, right? Obviously, in my home, both professionally and personally, I've followed Rick Doblin's work for years. I hope that, you know, as we see these things, clinical trials continue to prove themselves out, continue to have more relevant, bigger studies that prove what we already know, quite frankly, that it does work, that, you know, 30 to 40 years from now, we're not having a conversation that is confrontational about we didn't do things today as it relates to being able to take ownership, right, for introducing psychedelic assisted therapy into managed care in the United States healthcare system. At what point did practitioners that have come before us allowed certain therapeutic categories to be completely hijacked, right? And so the question, I think a big question that we have to, or a big conversation that we have to have as clinicians, as healthcare professionals in general, is even in the administrative wing, even at the C-suite level in the boardrooms, is going to be what's that fine line? What's that boundary? Because that will happen quickly. It will happen quickly. Everything will be synthesized. Beautiful indigenous plant medicine will be synthesized and sold back to us for thousands of dollars per dose. It will become unaffordable. We will have to look at other resources. Then we will go back to this idea of decriminalization and legalization of plant medicine. And now there will be two sides, a movement argument and a clinical argument. And as opposed to it being integrated, right, and everybody being on the same team, it will be two different movements that are moving parallel, hoping to accomplish one goal with two different modalities. And we know what happens in the U.S. healthcare with that. When you create that much division in the clinical community for those people that want to protect it, and don't want pharma to control it, versus the reality that, yes, you know, we can get both sides of the aisle to get on board with this from a legislative perspective. But the question is why? The answer is money. The answer to that question is money. Has nothing to do with hope and healing, and providing services to vulnerable and marginalized populations. Right? Mm-hmm. Why certain sides of the aisle get excited about it is because their hedge fund and private equity owners are really excited about research and development. So we have to take a step back and say, what's the role of clinicians, inpatient, outpatient? What's the role of pharmacists, and how is managed care going to treat this both from a formulary perspective as well as from a coding perspective, so that I think that, you know, collectively we all need to be a part of that conversation. So again, we don't turn, and we have this opportunity, guys. Gen X, millennials, and Gen Y have an opportunity for the first time to introduce a therapeutic care category that could revolutionize primary mental health and addiction treatment. We do not want the BUCAs of the world. Yep. We do not want the third party, what I call the third party cartels, to bastardize something that's beautiful and is saving people's lives.
Unfortunately, Dr. Ryan, Paul, money drives this country. And as much as I know that you hate it, it's going to be driving this movement also. And
understood.
I think, unfortunately, you and I are not going to be able to do much about it. We're going to go for the ride, and we're going to try to find ways to, you know, work with it the best that we can. I think a big part of it is that we're too top heavy. There's too many people at the top. They want to take a piece of it. So not enough gets left behind for the people at the bottom, who we are. We are at the bottom because we're the ones administering it. We're the ones spending the time with the patients, you know, doing the healing. And so when the pie gets so big, you know, and everybody wants a little slice, this is what happens. But it's the only way we can make it go to market and be accessible to everybody. We have to give a small piece of the pie to all these other people that have nothing to do with healing or have ever seen a patient in their life. And so, yeah, unfortunately, this is how our system is built in the United States, is that we are, unfortunately, Dr. Ryan,
we're very profit-driven. I just don't see
it. This country. I wish it wasn't that way.
And at the same time, we're seeing a lot of these, like, mega corporations in the psychedelic industry.
Unfortunately, you and I are not going to be able to do much about it.
Ketamine wellness centers, synthesis. And there seems to be something about this paradigm shift that's coming out that seems to be self-correcting in a way that really gives me a lot of hope.
Yeah, I 100% concur.
We're too top-heavy. There's too many people at the top.
I guess for me, it's, you know, we have a global health practice. So, you know, we're working in industrialized nations that are providing a level of socialized medicine, versus my entire life and my family background has been driven around a profit-driven model in the U.S. healthcare system. I was just the one child that viewed it very differently, right? And so, you know, yes, I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, like what we said before the conversation, I love how Dr. Gabor Mate kind of frames it, right? You know, those practitioners and clinicians that are doing great work, that are bringing value, that are bringing hope and healing to patients, they should be compensated very well. And it's okay for them to be rewarded. That's not the problem. The problem is that when the system prefers the dividend and the shareholder over the patient. And, you know, so like our practice, when we build systems, right, our entire business model in the United States is, if I come in and finance it for free in a rural healthcare system, whatever it might be, plan, build, and operate, whether it's an infusion clinic, specialty pharmacy, primary mental health center, MAT clinic, if I build it and I give you the infrastructure, right, so that you can drive a profitable opportunity as a not-for-profit institution, as a public health institution, to compete against the Fortune 500 companies that would want to extract from your community, will you let me do it, right? And so what that happens is that both sides of the aisle can agree on the fact that we're localizing patient care. So we have to take that mode of operation as it relates to ketamine. But for me, it's the conversation is about psychedelic assisted therapy. I don't categorize, just personally, I mean, I understand from a language perspective and the way in which we define, but I don't see ketamine as a psychedelic assisted therapy, as in my personal experience. I just see it as plant medicine. So that's more of a personal experience than it is, you know, a practical professional experience. But where we're focused, right, is how do we protect this? Which means, like, for instance, in pharmacology, right, pharmacists are like the first people, they're like the first line of defense to see people that are hurting, right? Point of service all the time, both primary mental health, on a daily basis because they're coming in and they're getting their psych meds. They're coming in getting their MAT. They're just interacting. So for us, we believe that that aspect, pharmacology and pharmacotherapy and pharmacovigilance that's required as we synthesize some of these indigenous plant medicines are really important to being able to protect it, right? And so if you are introducing these in smaller communities and rural areas where these indigenous communities already have had these practices in place for thousands of years, and they understand the modality of how this brings healing to people, then we can then, clinicians can start to enter into a conversation about how what this looks like from a managed care perspective and how we introduce it. I'm going to probably die having the, I am opposed to the way in which we deliver a reimbursement in the United States, but on the same token, we are primarily having that conversation every single day and we are making change, right? We are 100%, you know, what we're specifically doing is 100% changing the paradigm shift about the way in which the Blues, United, Cigna, and Humanas operate in communities because we're localizing patient care and we're taking away their authority because we're using their technology tools and other resources, other financial resources to combat their ability to be able to extract from the patient experience, which is clinicians' ability to be able to deliver care and institutions locally being able to provide care and pay for care.
Well, I even want to go back to just a little bit of what you're talking about, this like synthesization of some of these plant medicines. And I mean, the era of mental health being a chemical imbalance is kind of coming to an end. Like that definitely plays a role in what causes mental health and genetics and all that sort of thing. But we're learning more and more that it's not just that, it's your gut health, it's your inflammation levels in your body. And there are so many different ways that the original medicine might be working beyond just mimicking serotonin. And when we start making synthetic versions, we're taking away some of the other compounds that might be benefiting a person.
Yes, there's nothing more to say. That is it right there, 100%. Nail on the head.
Well, that's how all pharmacy drugs are made. They went to the Amazon and they mm-hmm. talked to the shamans and the native people there, and these guys were like, oh, this is the plant we use for migraines. So pharmacy came, they took that plant, they basically extracted the most active compound, discarded everything else. And we just don't know that everything is working in synergism with each other. All those little tiny chemicals, they get discarded. So,
and then we go over there and we actually burn things down and we lose plants that probably could have done a lot more.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Problem is you're decreasing our biodiversity on this planet, and this is what will lead to, you know, planet death eventually. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately.
I think that from a reimbursement perspective, I think that we need to, I mean, if you look at most industrialized nations that have some level of socialized medicine, they have really mastered the idea of value-based care and bundling payment arrangements, right? So that outcomes are attached to reimbursement. That's another way. And I think Jordan, you made a great point about the self-correcting, right? Because if you just have, and again, believe me, none of this is lost on me, right? You know, a lot of how we make a living and a lot of how our executive decisions are driven are based on synthesized pharmacology, right? We are in the pharmacology business. So believe me when I say that I'm not against it, but I think that from a value-based outcomes perspective, I think that that's a way for us to move forward from a reimbursement model to be able to protect some of this. Because if it's outcomes-driven, you are going to get a lot of the quantity-driven organizations are just not going to have the reimbursement success that smaller organizations that are truly proving out high numbers of success rates. Right. I mean, imagine that the addiction treatment as we see it today was reimbursed based on outcomes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, if 99% of them are owned by private equity and hedge funds, would they actually be as valuable as they are today? The answer is no, because at 2-3%, right, from a residential to a PHP to an ILP to an aftercare program, right, and the recidivism of chronic relapsing, if it was a value-based model and they were getting paid based on outcomes, they would be screwed as it relates to their financial position, right? And so I think that in mental and behavioral health, there's this unique opportunity to reward at the field level, like you said, Dr. Sophia, the people that are in, you know, in the trenches working with the patients, reward those people first for the outcomes that they're producing, because they're really providing individualized care and they are not focused on scaling some type of business model to see how many patients we can reach as quickly as possible with this new version of psilocybin or MDA is on the plate now, and all of a sudden there's an explosion, which there will be, right? But there is integrity will correct itself. You know, the integrity of the system, I believe, can correct itself so that clinicians have the ability to be, again, rewarded for those outcomes versus it just being flat fee for service. And I think there's some success opportunity in that.
Yeah. Well, although I agree with you that we should reimburse on outcomes, what the problem I see is how do we measure those outcomes? Because our measuring tool can be something that could actually not play towards our favor. And so we saw this with the opioid crisis, right? It was outcome driven. You want your patient's pain score to be zero. And this is what led a lot of clinicians to prescribe and overprescribe opioids for things that were not needed, because this was an outcome that they were using, the insurance companies were using in order to reimburse you. It was called the sixth vital sign was the pain. So, I mean, although I agree with you, it should be outcome driven, but how do we measure outcomes with the most sincere outcomes? You know, that's the part that I think is going to be the most challenging here.
And to take that a step further, I think as a person who runs a small little private practice that's focused specifically on marginalized communities, how do we not replicate the whole thing that happened with No Child Left Behind, where all of a sudden the most impoverished community is going to have lower outcome scores because it's not just the mental health, it's the system around them, it's their environment, it's chronic poverty, it's discrimination. Those, you know, mental health markers of outcomes are going to be a slower process than people who have all the resources they need outside of the clinic. And so how do we, if we move towards an outcomes-based measurement, I remember when this was first, I was working in a mental health clinic specifically for refugees, and we were having this discussion as outcomes-based measurements were slowly kind of filtering into our reimbursement. And it's scary when you know how long some of the work happens, and it's not going to be built into the averages because you're working with specifically the people at the margins of those averages.
Yeah, so I think that, and that's great. Those are both very great points. So the way that I would address that is number one, there is fee for service that exists within value-based systems. The bottom line is there needs to be some baseline of this is what you get paid per patient per month to keep these people healthy. And there are, and value-based should be a reward system based on long-term outcomes and mental and behavioral health in general. Because you're right. I mean, these things are not happening overnight. We are not getting, we are not, you know, it's not a 16-week therapy, right? And then all of a sudden, you know, I no longer have whatever it might be. You know, if you, how we treat value-based in our models in our sexual health division is going to be very different the way in which we're going to reimburse or create a model for mental and behavioral health or even reimbursement at the pharmacy, right? So I think that we need to kind of get rid of the idea that the way in which the United States has defined value-based and the way in which accountable care organizations and managed service organizations and Medicare and Medicaid have defined value-based needs to be flipped on side of its head. Because that's where, I mean, the bottom line is that's worthless. So we have to think of more of a global definition of what value-based is, which means is that our children not going to school hungry, right? Is there a reduction in inequity and disparity in that community? Are we overcoming specific guidelines as it relates to improving social determinants of health in a particular geographic location? Is type 2 diabetes going down in the minority community in the Midwest? I mean, these are the type of questions that we have to ask to be able to actually truly have an evidence-based practice that's tied to a value-based reimbursement. And again, I would even say that we need to redefine what evidence-based means because health, you know, because Blues, United, Cigna, and Humana in the managed care industry has kind of redefined that, right? For the sake of saying, we're just not going to reimburse for it because it's not evidence-based. But we know in this space that we're talking about that something that we would have never been able to, that at best would have been a correlation, right? And we can talk about the epidemiology of psychedelic assisted therapy. Love that as an epidemiologist. But if we go there specifically, what we will find is that what works for me, right? What has kept me sober and what has kept me in my recovery and how I define that is very different than somebody that's defining that without psilocybin, in an abstinence-based program, those types of things. And so unfortunately, the net has to be much broader And we have to look at quality of life as the determinants for outcome versus some type of, clear scientific definition, because we all know that when it's at the end of the day, that because there is multi-modalities that need to be integrated into what this looks like. And we can talk about integration, and I think you guys can talk about integration extensively, which I think is an important topic, Jacob, for us to hit on while we're on this, is how these
integration psychedelics and ketamine.
Just integration in and of itself. I take a therapy, right? How is that changing my life? What's coming? What am I drawing out of that? And how is that impacting my quality of life? What's changing about that? Because as that change happens, which as Jordan and Dr. Sophia implied, is going to take a lot longer, right, than a Sovaldi therapy for Hep C, right? How do we measure that? Well, Jordan, Dr. Sophia, you need to be drawing up those guidelines. We need to be, as a community, having those conversations to say this is what it looks like, so that when – so that the right people are coming up with. I remember when Dr. Dixie, my life partner, developed the evidence-based practice, which now backs up biofeedback as a reimbursable expense for managed care organizations. It was her dissertation at Saybrook, and she was on a mission to get biofeedback to be reimbursed by Blues, United, Cigna, and Humana. She spent beyond her dissertation. She finally made it happen, right? Today, biofeedback is considered evidence-based practice in addiction treatment, and managed care organizations will reimburse, right, primary mental health and addiction treatment organizations in an outpatient setting for that service, right? Mm-hmm. And the reason why biofeedback's so cool is because it was a clinician that was practicing with that biofeedback in her own addiction treatment practice that convinced managed care. And so what I would suggest is that we have to hurry up both on the clinical and in the administrative side to capture what could get away from us, because what happens is, if we don't take control of this today, and I just had this conversation with the Psychedelic Pharmacists Association a couple months ago when I gave a presentation to them, somebody else will decide that for you, right? And so that is my concern, right? That's my concern. I want to be able to protect the clinicians that are delivering services to our patients. And without that type of integrity, without you guys, right, making the decision about what that looks like, it will be guys like me in my position, right, that are providing third-party administrative services between clinics and those that reimburse. And that community will decide. And then you, 10 years from now, will be pissed off about that decision, trying to figure out how to undo something that, as Dr. Sophia implied, will never change in our lifetime, right? And so that's my concern today, is that we're not getting a hold of these things today to prevent the catastrophe, which is reimbursement and outcomes-based reimbursement in the managed care system today.
So I'd like to throw in another twist into this conversation. This is going to go back a little bit, but we have to also consider the confounding factor of patient effort. And in our practice, we have discovered that patient effort is a huge determinant of whether or not you will be successful with the kind of therapy that we're doing. And so then, how do you measure outcomes? How do you measure how well I did my job when the patient that I'm dealing with has put in zero effort? You know, is it because I'm not a good clinician? Is it because I don't know what I'm doing, or I didn't put enough effort into it? You know, because the outcome for that person is going to be poor because the effort was poor. So we have to also consider that as well. Number two is that I want Dr. Paul to talk a little bit more about this. You have identified the problem, which is wonderful, and that's also always the first step. But what I'm not hearing is, I'm not hearing solutions. I'm not hearing how clinicians are going to take over and make those decisions and get to those areas that you are, you know, saying that we need to be. And this is, I think, the most challenging part, because I'm ready to do it. I just don't know one where to start, who to go to, or whether or not those people are even going to care to listen to me. I'm just one clinician with one private practice.
Another thing I want to add, kind of going into the outcomes part, is within medicine, general medicine, primary care, let's say we're looking at outcomes for diabetes or blood pressure, we have very specific markers for that. We can measure your blood pressure a month from now, 2 months from now, your hemoglobin A1C for diabetes. One of the things that we also are always looking at within our clinic is how are we actually measuring this, whether this is rating scales or most of it. What we do is we take the rating scales and we add that to our clinical interpretation of it, but that is in itself is fairly subjective. So I'm always also curious about, is there additional ways where we can objectively measure outcomes? Is this something that we could integrate with measuring someone's sleep over time, how much activity they're getting? Is there additional technology that can be used into these ways of actually giving objective data to payers in the future?
Yeah, those are great insights. So I can tell you what we do at WellLife, because I can't solve every community's problem. We can only solve the problems of those organizations and communities that invite us to help solve the problem. But I'll give you an example. A town of 2,000 people in the Midwest. They have a critical access hospital that's having huge financial problems to the point of them closing. They have one primary care general practice across the street from the hospital. All 2,000 of those people go to that practice. Those physicians have not collaborated with the hospital. The hospital is what's called a 340B covered entity, right? They're a critical access hospital. They have the ability to be able to utilize a federal drug subsidy program called the 340B drug pricing program that was passed in 1992 by Bush Sr. and then re-upped by Clinton a handful of years later. And what that does is it allows critical access hospitals, disproportionate share hospitals, Ryan White clinics for the HIV/AIDS community, STD clinics, tuberculosis clinics, there's a long list, federally qualified health centers, to be able to purchase medication at deep, deep discounts, right? So like an example would be Humira right now, before we move to a biologic, which we are moving to a biologic very quickly on Humira as an example. But right now it's about $8,200 retail into the market. You know, if you look at average wholesale price minus a discount, we can purchase Humira for about 10 cents through that federal program, right? So that huge margin, right, is margin that was originally set up, right? That federal law was set up to force pharmaceutical companies to subsidize uncompensated and charitable care, right? So this is where I'm going. We're going to produce $10 million in that population to provide uncompensated and charitable care services and to prop up a failing critical access hospital as a result of giving them the tools and resources they need for all of those physicians across the street and everyone that's practicing at the hospital to build an outcomes-based program where Blues, United, Cigna, Aetna, Humana are only necessary if Medicaid's being managed by them or it's a Medicare program. So the entire commercial population is now going to be localized, right? And everything is going to be direct, right? So pharmaceuticals are going to be bought at a very low rate and then purchased and then sold into the commercial market in direct relationships for all of the employer groups and the individual health insurance plans. It's creating localized economy, a circular economy for everything that is medicine in that community. And so now what happens is that now they can say, look, if you want to reimburse and be a part of the life cycle of all 2,000 people that live in this community, Blues, United, Cigna, and Humana, here's our contract, reimbursement contract. This is how you participate in our program. This is how you, deploy your provider network resources. So in rural communities, it's quite easy because what we're doing is we're saying we don't need managed care. We can localize all of it so that the Jordans and the Dr. Fishers and the Dr. Sophias are a part of what outcomes look like, right? And so when we get to the very difficult idea of so remember in value-based care, outcomes reimbursement is based on populations, not on individuals, right? So from a patient, it's a great point, Dr. Sophia. So from a patient effort, right, you're not getting dinged because somebody they weren't ready yet. They weren't ready to do the really hard work of dealing with X, right? And that is no fault of the clinicians. But there are lots of situations where it's the fault of the clinicians, right? In this particular situation, patient effort, the answer is no. But in value-based outcomes in general, and the way it's operating in the rest of the world, it's population, it's the public health, it's the epidemiological look at what is the how is the population performing, right? Where were we? Where are we now? What does recidivism look like? What does remission look like in any therapeutic category? And those types of markers can be applied in a reward-based system for clinicians over a long period of time to reflect things like social determinants of health, how the community is interacting with each other. Is there access that didn't, where there was an access? And so again, localizing that care and removing some of managed care to create an outcomes-based system and a value-based model in those communities is that's what we're doing. I mean, that is absolutely what we're doing, is saying, are these third parties necessary? And if they are not, if they are getting in the way of patient care, if they are actually hurting the clinicians and their ability to be able to thrive financially so that they want to continue to stay in medical deserts and take care of a vulnerable and marginalized community because that's what they feel called to, but the Blues, United, Cignettas, and Humanas of the world are actually extracting, right? So here's the point. The point is like in the pharmacotherapy world, if you look at 340B drug pricing programs, which is creating margin, right, to pay for uncompensated and charitable care for not-for-profit hospitals and health centers. If you look at federal and state grants that drive hospitals and health centers in not-for-profit medical communities where counties have less than 250,000 inpatient populations, and then you look at the rural areas within those counties that usually have less than 30,000 in the community, 80 cents of every single dollar is going to Wall Street, right? Mm-hmm. And then we have to ask as clinicians and as administrators locally, do we even need these people? Like, at what point did we decide that that was a good idea, right? So what we're doing is we're simply saying all of the technology, the claims adjudication technology, the clinical services, all of the things that managed care says that they create value in, which really they're just tools to extract, we'll give you all of those so that we've overcome that obstacle of you not having those things, and then let's reimagine it. And here's the really cool part. Conservatives and liberals, they all get together and they recognize that this is about public health. It's not about politics, right? So we don't have a conversation about health insurance as a, you know, as a right versus a privilege. We don't have those conversations. And we're doing this in the heartland, right? This is not something that I'm doing outside of San Francisco or in the liberal parts of Westchester County, New York. We're doing this in the heartland and people are getting really excited about it. So again, that's part of it. It's about like us persuading the system that they can actually make money by disintermediating the big players that are ultimately extracting from those communities. And so that's what we hope to accomplish. Nothing more than that.
I see Dr. Brown in the chat has offered mm-hmm. a little bit of information about just encouraging us as clinicians to get involved in research. I also want to just offer another kind of route that I found really effective in getting involved, which is just community advocacy. So in Illinois, we're currently trying to pass a bill called HB1 that would legalize psilocybin, decriminalize it, but specifically set it up first and foremost as a licensed medicine that can be grown, distributed, practiced and received, right? As a kind of template for additional psychedelic medicines, as a template for kind of growing beyond the therapeutic use, but we're trying to get that through. And so showing up to the town halls for that type of legislation, getting involved, getting connected to the people who are actually pushing that through. Illinois has the Illinois Psychedelic Society. Getting involved with your local chapter, and almost everywhere has a psychedelic society. And if not, the Global Psychedelic Society will help you set up a chapter. What's really cool about the way that HB1 is going through is because there's NTHO Illinois who's kind of putting it through, but then it's sponsored by a member of the state. And so they're going to be looking to the clinicians and the advocates who are helping put it through to help develop the training curriculum. And so I've signed on to a group of people kind of in anticipation of that going, becoming legalized to help with the training curriculum. Because once we establish a training curriculum that's legalized mm-hmm. on the state level, then we're kind of creating these case studies, Oregon, Colorado, you know, maybe Illinois eventually, that will be able to generate additional data, even if you don't have, you know, in my case, I don't have a PhD to be able to PI a research study. The other route that I'm kind of looking at is I'm working with a group of people to develop a psychedelic access fund for the Chicago area. Our hope is to be able to provide this to specifically the marginalized communities that I talked about so often get left out of national averages, and be able to generate data based on their outcomes of what works, what doesn't work, and be able to do a little bit of training for the facilities where maybe the outcomes aren't that great, and just kind of create a microcosm of a lot of what Dr. Paul is talking about there.
That's great. So you guys are working on a fund?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
That's really cool. What does PI mean? Like,
oh, a principal investigator. So the person who heads a research study.
Okay. No, that's very interesting. Yeah, that's good.
Well, the Ozmind platform is kind of helping with that. And this is one of the things why I like that platform is because I do give them all my data points. And they do run large meta-analyses. And it does have a lot of power because there's so many data points there. You know, unfortunately, again, it's not standardized because they pull data points from all different clinics. However, different clinics have different protocols, different ways that they do their therapy, or maybe they don't do any therapy at all. So those points get grouped up with, you know, the ones with therapy. But again, it's a nice start. It's publicly funded. And so when you don't have a lot of funding to do these research studies, it's nice to, you know, I think that they're going down the right route. I don't know if they have everything lined up perfect, but, you know, they're trying. And I think it's the best try I've seen so far. To try to kind of force payers to see that, okay, this is working, you need to make this an on-label type of treatment. But it's going to take time because just like every other research, it takes time. And then somebody has to validate your research at the end, and that's, you know.
Isn't MAPS, I heard, having major funding issues for the research? I don't know, I heard from somebody like Rick Doblin was like, again, trying to get more money for research because he doesn't want to go to the private sector. I don't know. But again, I heard MAPS was struggling with funds.
Yeah, that's an interesting community that's happening in Cambridge and Boston right now. A lot of critiques in Cambridge, right, about all of that, because you have the for-profit side,
mm-hmm,
right, that's ultimately, yes, holding the patents. And then you have the foundation side that's trying to drive the research and trying to figure out how you separate that. That's difficult, right? Yeah, I won't even get into that, but I think that, you know, something that I've been very 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 critical, primarily in the infectious disease and pharmaceutical epidemiological community and in the research and development community as it relates to neglected tropical diseases, as we do work overseas, and some of the, well, not some of the hundreds of millions and billions of dollars that are pumped into the system by UNICEF, World Bank, Clinton Health Access Initiative, Gates Foundation, Wellcome Trust, great organizations doing great work, right? Until your malaria nets kill all the coastal fish and people are out of work, or the billions of dollars that you're pumping into research and development aren't translating into patient care in some of the poorest places of the world. And that in and of itself is a conversation that we have a lot. And I think that when I have this conversation, I guess we'll just say the academic community, that I can tell you guys, I'm very far removed from the academic community. I've been a social entrepreneur for a long time and quite frankly been very critical of it, right? It wasn't until the beautiful Dr. Dixie Brown gave me a really great perspective of why this work is so important beyond the dissertation, because she's been a PI on a lot of different projects. She would bring some great insight to this. Is that we have to make sure that when we're doing all of this, that it's translating, right? And so I think that, you know, Holden Fitzgerald, you know, as the management consulting firm that's competing against the McKinseys and the Deloittes and the BCGs and the Topsas of the world that control both global public health by way of, right, investment banks and all of these things to really make markets for themselves, which is unfortunate and flies in the face of the reason why we would even do this in the first place. But that's the way it works. No different than what Dr. Sophia said about this is just the system that we have. And although I don't mind a flavor of capitalism that's Scandinavian, it just doesn't suit us that healthcare isn't a utility in the United States, just from a financial perspective, much less an SDOH disparity and equity issue. But what we do a really poor job of, right, as scientists, is making the argument for why this is a reduction or an increase in financial position for the moneymakers and for the kingmakers. my job at Holden Fitzgerald and Well Life is not to be in the field making sure that the really incredible work is being done. In fact, I just hired an incredible pharmacologist that's run some incredible not-for-profit organizations to be the president and COO of Well Life because I am tired, right, of not being a part of the fun. But as scientists, what we've not done is made a case for ourselves in how we translate this really great R&D and really great clinical work and really great studies and really great aha moments into this is how you're going to make money. This is how we're going to reduce the cost. And this is how we're going to take care of everyone. And this is your margin, right? Because when we get to the end of a dissertation, we don't say, and this is how Wall Street's going to make a 15% profit margin. We usually don't translate that. But what I've found is I call it the Robin Hood effect, right? Is I go to these large institutions and say, you're going to give me all of your resources and you're going to give them to me for free. And I'm going to show you how to take care of 100% of the community in an equitable and equal way. And you are going to make more money because you are going to capitalize on the fact that you are spending less money on sickness, right? And more money on prevention. And what will happen is the reinsurance, the medical loss ratios, the stop loss, all of the financial tools that are really driving shareholder value will increase. So we have a private equity firm that gives us money up to $1 million to go into these rural communities. I don't have to use my own money. And I guarantee them a 5-year contract and they're going to return anywhere from 22 cents to 35 cents on the dollar in actual shareholder value while I'm giving away their money for free. Because the performance of a healthier system where they're adjudicating claims and taking margin out of the system, that 17 cents on the dollar becomes more profitable than that 80 cents on the dollar because they're going to aggregate larger communities. They're going to become healthier over a long period of time, which means they're going to spend less money in chronic illness, in readmissions into the hospital, into ICU visits, into things like wound biologics, like epigraft and dermograft for the diabetes community. And when we translate this really good work of, hey, we know this works, and we've got this cohort that has proven that it works, we miss that third step, which is the Robin Hood, what I call the Robin Hood effect, which is go to the big boys and say, we're either gonna steal from you, or we're going to allow you to participate in what we're going to do moving forward. And what it does is it changes the landscape of, if we're proving that this works, then we just need your money, but we need your money for free. And if you give us your money for free, then we will make sure that your return is more than you putting it back into the market. And so I think that when we have that conversation as scientists and actually learn that as a skill to be able to communicate the relative nature of why we're doing this in the first place, it puts us in a position of power that, quite frankly, we're not in right now, right? Because it doesn't matter how good of a clinician you are. It doesn't matter how great of a scientist or doctor you are. Wall Street, private equity, and hedge funds do not care, right? They absolutely do not care what you're doing. They do not care about your patient. And when they talk about your patients, they talk about them in dollars and cents, not in outcomes and healing. So I think that, again, if we take that whole philosophy and apply it to psychedelic-assisted therapy, everyone should be very concerned about the fact that MAPS has a for-profit and a not-for-profit. And why a for-profit? And what are the backroom deals that are being made with the pharmaceutical industry that are going to get in the way of psilocybin and MDA and ultimately ketamine and ibogaine and ayahuasca and all of the other things that will ultimately end up synthesizing in the psychedelic community? How is that going to get in the way of equality for the vulnerable and marginalized community? The answer is it's already started. So again, that's why I want to have that conversation. And I'm telling you that I won't accept, you know, I'm not like a accept the things you cannot change, the courage to change the things you can. I am 100% going to change the things that I do not accept, right? And so that's the position that we're taking. And we are in a position where we do have capital to be able to say those wild things and be undiplomatic. But we want people like the people that are on this call to support that effort and lend their voice, because I think that we can collectively do something that's radically different than what we think is the right thing. Because what is the right thing and who the big players are, they do not have your best interest in mind. I promise you that.
Of course, nobody is arguing with you about that. They only care about themselves. But I think your point is excellent. And unfortunately, I have tried to drive this concept with insurance companies myself on the phone. letting them know that they can extract a lot more money from a patient that's alive and thriving versus somebody who commits suicide because they didn't get mental health treatment. However, the problem that I see is that they are too short-sighted. They do not care about 10 years from now. They just care about the next quarter or the next year. And this is a huge thing that's getting in the way because they don't have that like perspective into the future. So I think you're 100% right. I 100% support this Robin Hood thing because I think that is the answer. I just have found it very difficult to try to kind of get this into people's heads and thinking about it in this way, that if we have a healthier population, that population will be coming to the emergency room less. So you'll be spending less resources there and, you know, you'll have payers for much longer and people who are still working, who are producing taxes and the tax base will be higher. But again, I find it difficult to kind of drive that concept with those payers. And I've had those heated conversations on the phone with them. And it just falls on deaf ears. You know, they don't care.
You're right. You're 100% right. You're right.
We're talking with also people that aren't actually clinicians. There's the administrator. Yeah. And we're trying to convince them. And if we can get this person's depression under control, they're not going to end up in the hospital. Like, they're going in once a month.
But this doesn't affect their direct paycheck, so they don't give a shit if it affected their direct paycheck, but I think it should. You know, if there's more readmissions at your hospital, then the administrators get dinged on their paycheck. But, you know, we protect those guys. We protect the guys at the top, and everything else falls on us and on the taxpayers eventually because, you know.
Yeah, and there are some digital solutions that we're deploying to, again, it's about disintermediation. So something that we do in the U.S., as it relates to delivering care is always, the strategy is always, when can we disintermediate, right? So like we can't disintermediate Medicaid. We can't disintermediate Medicare when they're paying through a PDP at one of our pharmacies. But what we can disintermediate is Blues forcing through Epic and Allscripts to use their telehealth platform, which ultimately allows them to medical bill, take 10%, and then take provider network fees, and then reduce your reimbursement by 50%. We can do that. So again, there's some of these intricacies of how do we, if there's this patient population that you're serving at the in the field level versus the reimbursement level, along the way, there are 15 middlemen that are trying to create some value proposition to extract. And so our job is just to crunch that down as much as possible and then say, now we have the authority of 15 middlemen, but as opposed to a private company having the authority of 15 middlemen, we've handed ownership of it to the public health institution. And then we have my rock stars on the back end who know exactly, because we're all people that know exactly how to force a PA or step therapy or to not approve an appeal for a surgery. Like those are the people. So like we know how to screw people. It's just, we're not doing that anymore, right? Like that's the reality. The reality is I just have a bunch of rock stars that know exactly how we participated in the fleecing of America by working for these institutions. And then I went and found the best of the best and said, do you want to do the exact same opposite, you know, the exact opposite of what you used to do for public health institutions? And I believe that this applies very specifically to psychedelic assisted therapy, because when Jordan, when you talk about vulnerable and marginalized communities, let's just take the sub segment of that and talk about indigenous people and the reality that we are having a political change in America. People care more about indigenous populations and doing the right thing than we ever had, right? Because we're raising a generation of children that are learning things that you and I never read in history books when we were going through kindergarten through fifth grade. Like I didn't know. I mean, I was like 30 before I knew half the stuff that I knew today. So I think with that, there's this, again, this unique opportunity to get that community, the indigenous community involved. Again, part of the reason why, like, for instance, we do a lot of on-site pharmacy management for tribal communities, right? Because they get what's called most favored nation. This is going to be a really great pilot opportunity because they're going to be able to separate certain opportunities from federal law to be able to institute psychedelic assisted therapy to deal with primary mental health substance use disorders in a meaningful way. And I don't know if you want to, Jacob, but I'd love to get Jordan and Dr. Sophia and Dr. Fisher to talk a little bit more about, like, let's get away from, you know, the Ryan conversation about managed care and reimbursement and into, like, I want to hear your guys' thoughts about, like, what does this look like, right? synthesized or not, what does this look like for somebody that has long-term recovery from alcohol use disorder, that is very scared that people that don't have means like me, right, are not going to have access to, and it's a small percentage of people that have alcohol use disorder that use psilocybin, has a harm reduction tool, but are not going to have access to this. It's going to give the federal government another reason to incarcerate people, right? Because now they're getting it in unsafe ways. And by unsafe, I don't mean an unsafe supply.
It's underground. They have to go underground again.
Yeah, but they're underground. So now they're putting them in an unsafe situation. And then as a byproduct of that, creates an unsafe supply. No different than we have in other class one scheduled drugs. So I'd love to hear your guys' feedback about, like, at the patient level, about, like, what's that vision for that? You know, we know where the patients are at. We know harm reduction. We know all of these things. How are we taking an understanding of that clinical versus that access issue? And how do you guys think, you know, the future of psychedelic assisted therapy specifically is going to drive opportunity for your patient population? And how are you as a clinician going to protect your patients from the ramifications of being able to enter into a healing relationship with you?
I'm definitely on the staunch belief that we need both decriminalization and legalization, because there are going to be those people who do utilize their healthcare, myself included, to the point that they max out their benefits by the end of or the beginning of the year. And then the legalized substance would be, you know, potentially covered as a valid medicine under their healthcare plan, versus the people who don't use their healthcare, don't have access to healthcare insurance and want to grow their own, or maybe some mix in between, right? We need to decriminalize and get people out of jails for things that people are now making mega bucks on. I also think that harm reduction is a great kind of middle ground in the meantime. Like if a person comes to me and they're already using a substance, what am I going to do? I'm going to make sure that they're getting proper preparation. They're getting proper integration, that whatever their experiences are, they're getting as much positive out of it. And we're addressing any of the potential challenges that come with psychedelics. You also mentioned for people with addiction patterns. And I think that that's where the role of integration is so important is, yeah, we're dealing with medicines that are relatively low on the chemical dependency scale. That said, I mean, gambling can be addictive, sex can be addictive, food can be addictive. So if a person has that kind of addictive personality, it's just that much more important that we're building a bridge between this place that a person goes and their day-to-day life, so that instead of it becoming an escape that they go to on a day, you know, their medicine days, it becomes, this is what I'm learning over here. How do I bring that back to my day-to-day? And I'm keeping my feet on the ground in my day-to-day life.
It's great. It's well said.
I think also what's really interesting is this thought about how there's individual clinics and individual clinicians, and then there's the other side where it's the thinking kind of larger networks, and like we mentioned, these companies that have kind of fallen away because they just were too big and backed by venture capital. And you know, a lot of what we're dealing with though is such intimate details of people's lives, and have giving them a place that's really safe to share. Particularly in issues with addiction or depression or suicidality, where people feel comfortable. But what I think what we're starting to look at too is that there's such a big demand and need. So being able to provide that care from a really personal level, but also to start to provide that to more people in a safe way. So that's another thing that I think is an important part with this discussion, is looking at getting that really quality personalized care, but also being able to open that up to more people, because that need is really there. And that's something that I'm constantly thinking about.
Yeah, I mean, this is integrative work. And I tell people that doesn't just refer to the type of integration therapy people get, but the idea that we're integrating between professions. I mean, we have several doctors on here, different kind of perspectives. Myself as a clinician, we have Jacob advocating and getting us all together, right? We want to involve patients in their care, but we also want to be able to, you know, when I was working specifically in ketamine therapy, seeing that as kind of a short-term therapy and making sure that I had a team of clinicians I could refer off to for some of the longer care. Right? Making sure that I knew somebody, like if they had more spiritual concerns, I'm referring out to spiritual care so that a person is getting the right resources, right timeline, right theme, right specialty area.
Yeah, I actually really like this community because there's such a network, kind of, it's almost like an underground network of different providers that have different areas of interest and different specialties. You know, I'm a psychiatrist, Dr. Piba is an anesthesiologist. Within Sacramento, we have a network of different therapists that we work with and with people within primary care, other psychiatrists, and we just kind of all connect and know each other in such a, one of the nice things is that within this field is that there is that community. And so I really also enjoy that part of being able to refer people to when my tools might not be enough for that particular patient. You know, like we had talked a little bit about before at the before we started, is even other interventions, things like TMS. If, like, let's say we don't necessarily get the results that we see with ketamine, is being able to offer additional treatments for people that are really struggling, because there's so many patients in need, and be able to give that care to people is such an important part.
This work definitely demands kind of that ego dissolution that psychedelics so often bring up. Like, it's not about whether my treatment is the one that works for people, right? Like, I have no shame in saying, hey, you know, I haven't seen this be as effective for a person with your diagnosis. Have you considered TMS? Or we're not making as much progress as we had hoped by this point. Like, what else do we need to bring in?
Yeah, I know Stephanie had a good question. She brought up salt therapy. Have we ever, and red light therapy?
My understanding, based on kind of what that might be more for the inflammation standpoint. Yeah. I enjoy salt therapy and red light therapy for my chronic physical health conditions. I'm not as familiar with them for mental health, but if anyone else knows more.
Yeah, and it seems like she's implying the fact that although that's something that she's doing, that ultimately if she had a practitioner that could guide this woman through the psychedelic assisted therapy / ketamine process, that could benefit her greatly. Mm-hmm. I love what you said, Dr. Fisher, about this underground community. I think that that's kind of my implication at the beginning. Is that I've had a lot of these conversations, both in the managed care space and some of the associations that are popping up. How do we keep the heart of this, right? Like, so, I mean, for me, it's, again, I am what I am, right? We manage pharmacies. We dispense synthesized medications to 350,000 people in 36 states, you know? And I don't know people's opinion. I just know, like, I have such a deep personal experience and love, and, you know, these plant medicines are sacrament for me. I struggle with this, right? I struggle with this as someone that, you know, actively has a profession where I should be the one saying, let's synthesize this as quickly as possible. Let's get it in a pill bottle and let's pump it out so that people can get the help. And what I struggle with, I just struggle with the balance in what this has been for me and having a desire for people that have had similar struggles as me to be able to experience the love, the admiration, the care, the gentleness, the kindness, which is psilocybin. Who I am today, who you've listened to, is not the dude, even in sobriety, that I was before I took this path, right, in this journey. I was not, I had no spiritual life. My ambition was skewed. I spent most of my time extracting as opposed to trying to figure out what we could do to be a part of community and collective and socializing medicine, and having been a part of the other side of it, knowing that we could take those strategies and do something differently. So what I would put back out to you guys is where's that balance for you, right? Just personally, like, you know, in practice, but in worldview as well. Like, how do we keep that thing, that X factor, right, that people experience as a result of this, right? I mean, I remember the first time the first journey that I ever took. I mean, I can't even explain it. It wouldn't even do it justice, other than the Ryan before and the Ryan after were radically different, and that never left, right? So it wasn't like all of a sudden I was like, oh, you know, the addiction part of me was now seeking out that experience again. Never. I never like sought out, like, it wasn't like, hey, it's time to get psilocybin and go to a Fish concert. It was like, it was such a ceremonial, sacred experience that changed my life that I wanted to protect it. And I didn't want to remove the purity of it. So it was never a thing. And so how do we respect and love the community that's really having that conversation and draw them into an understanding of how can we have both, right? How can we have some, I guess, as Marshall Lenahan would put it, how can we have some wise mind about this, right? How can we have the and either, right? Or, and there doesn't have to be an or, there doesn't have to be a separation between the clinical aspirations in the plant-based, the plant medicine movement, and the decriminalization and the legalization movement.
I think it comes down to a lot of that rapport you're building with a person. I mean, my bias is always on the therapy, right? But making sure that you're assessing what the person needs and what your limits are. And if you don't feel comfortable providing a more ceremonial approach, who do you refer to offer that ceremonial approach? If a person does have increased medical needs and you don't have a doctor who sits with the patient, well, then who do you refer that maybe has a greater, you know, ability to provide first aid or, you know, emergency intervention? But I think that these things need to coexist for the very purpose of, we're not just talking about, again, we're not just talking about neurochemistry. We're talking about an entire paradigm shift where the experience is the medicine.
Yeah, that's such an important part, is that experience. It's not just, we're going to give you a medicine and it's going to do its thing. It's what's the process, what happens between sessions. That's such an important factor. So being able to connect with each individual patient and talk to them about that and having them understand it and be able to really buy into it, that's where the change happens.
Amen.
Agreed. Yeah, it just makes me happy. At the end of the day, I will jump into these calls every single time, because the bottom line is that I've seen the community that I participated in. I've seen the way in which they go about procuring and delivering plant medicine, and the way in which it's handled. And I think that, like you said, Jordan, it's, those things can be a part of clinical practice. And quite frankly, I think that for the most part, they will, especially in private practice, right? It doesn't have to be a sterile experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that people can choose that, their comfort level, because there is the individuals that are going to go to a very, you know, the very clinical approach. You know, it's not, you know, get off your psych meds, you know, have 2 to 3 weeks, you know, consult with your psych, get off the meds fast, mm-hmm. get ready, take, you know, integration, you know, 3 days afterwards, blah, blah, blah. It could be something that's a little bit different than the way in which I experience it. But I think that you guys particularly need to continue to have this discussion in your communities, and you probably are, about how we do this in a meaningful way. So that, again, I think it's really important to remember that, like, we genuinely, especially when you're talking about psilocybin and MDMA, like, it's an epic thing. And I think it will be lost on us if we don't remember that, like, generationally, right? We've got like 2 to 3 generations that are now experiencing, as clinicians and as practitioners and as scientists, something that we've never had the opportunity to experience for, which is usher in a new way of viewing primary mental health and addiction treatment. Not just in the United States, but across the globe. And I think that that is going to shatter, right, the status quo, right, and the way in which business has been done in mental health and addiction treatment. And I think that that's exciting, right? I think that that's incredibly exciting.
It is.
Because people are getting beat up out here, right?
It's a complete kind of perspective shift or paradigm shift in terms of treatment. In mental health, you know, it's not just take a medicine and we'll see you back in 4 to 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. It's completely different. It's not medicine just by itself.
Mm-hmm.
Well, perhaps we need to take a closer look at how Australia is going to do it, because, you know, they just decriminalized it or made it legal actually to be given in a medical setting. So. Mm-hmm. Ooh. I'm interested to see what their model is and see how it works out for them. You know, I mean, they're obviously way ahead of us, so we've got time to assess that model and hopefully improve it.
So interestingly, they are requesting help from Americans to be able to provide supervision to their clinicians.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Well, I don't
take it as a compliment.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think anybody knows what they're doing. They're just kind of going at it in the dark. And I think we're going to learn as we go, and we're going to make our mistakes. And unfortunately, we can't avoid those. But yeah, I mean, I don't know how to get in front of the big guys and talk. I mean, maybe Dr. Paul can help us do that.
I do. Like, I mean, it's not a flex. It's 100%. It's just what we do, right?
Yeah.
We just yell at these people all day long.
Feel free to invite us, the clinicians, to support you and to, you know, be there to have a voice at the table. Otherwise, we're going to be dinner, right? So,
yeah.
Yeah, and again, I think that, too, it's about us not thinking that we have kind of a singular way of going about solving these problems. And so, you know, a new 501c3 opens up and then all of a sudden we've got 50 that all want the same thing, but are not collectively working together. So that means less in funds. That means less ability to be able to have impact from a lobbying perspective. It means lesser dollars from a political action perspective. But again, we're working on really four components, which is safety, dosage, setting, integration, and legal considerations, right? So those are both healthcare and political, right? And delivery and design and public health. So if in those five components, if it always has to be, you know, what is the setting, what's the integration, what's the dosage, what's the legal considerations, and we're using those kind of points to kind of build each component. So like if I go and say, well, how are PharmDs going to participate in that? Well, it's going to be about setting, dosage, integration, an understanding of pharmacotherapy in general about how it's solving a problem and pharmacovigilance as it relates to if we are going to synthesize these drugs, how are they seeing responses in the field, right? What's the communication that they're getting back as those point of service practitioners that are having those questions, you know, getting those questions answered about medication therapy management, are engaging in drug counseling outside of the physician's office. And those, again, those are some of the questions that we're asking and we're trying to get our people to answer. And then going back to organizations like Psychedelic Pharmacists Association and some of the other organizations that operate in the pharmacological world to say, you know, what does this look like from a supportive mechanism? Because it won't always just exist in an outpatient bundled setting at the clinic. People will be taking this home. And so what's the ancillary opportunity? Because as you said, Jordan, you know, we want to be people to be able to grow. I also think that we want clinicians to be able to engage in that pathway as well, because there's a lot of clinicians that want to engage in a more non-clinical setting. And so how do we represent that community so that they're safe, so that they're getting the maximum aspect of therapy and integration and opportunity out of those medicines. And like Dr. Fisher said, like, what does that look like beyond just popping the pill? But you guys all know, it doesn't matter what it is. I mean, at some point there is that patient effort of, you know, I've gone through this, I've taken this journey. Now what, right? Mm-hmm. Now what does the rest of my life look like?
Yeah.
All good things for sure. Well, I just wanted to tell everyone that I had an absolute blast on the show. We got into so many great things, and it was truly an honor having all of you on. It really was.
Thank you so much. It was great to meet you, Dr. Paul, and to see you again, Dr. Piva and Dr. Fisher. I love being part of these conversations. Thank you for the invite, Jacob.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. I've learned so much today, and I'm really glad to see all the work that's being done here.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the show only because we discussed something other than what we always talk about. Mm-hmm. And I think Dr. Paul had a lot of really great insight, and I love hearing, you know, his perspective because he's obviously in a very different area, on a different level than where we are. And a lot of the times we don't even understand what happens on those levels. So, you know, thank you for, you know, being here and supporting this cause and, you know, being one of the people that can actually maybe make a more bigger difference than we can because of where you were at.
Small, just a little bit at a time, mm-hmm. little bit at a time. But thank you for your kind words and thank you for all the great work that you guys are doing. And we will continue this conversation. And let's figure out how we can support your efforts in your community so that you can have great success in the healing work that you're doing. Because at the end of the day, that's what it is. Thank you.
Amen. Thank you. I again want to give a special thanks to Jordan, Ryan, Sophia, and Christopher for being awesome and amazing special guests on my show. I learned so much from them, and it was a lot of fun. I just want to thank all of my listeners for your support, and just to inform everyone that the information expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a medical doctor or a licensed mental health therapist. And if anyone has any further questions for me, you can reach me at my email address, behaviorhealthintegration121@gmail.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn at Jacob Minig, where you will find more educational posts on psychotherapy, trauma, and addiction. And finally, you can follow me on my website, which is behaviorhealthintegration.org. I also want to inform everyone that there is a great new device out there called Calmigo. It's a breathing device meant to control and manage your breathing rates and the depth of your breathing as you inhale and exhale to, again, help relieve any type of anxiety and stress-like symptoms. And if you do put the BHI podcast into the promo code, you get $30 off this amazing device. It is a once-in-a-lifetime deal, and you will not be disappointed. All right, everyone, until next time, have a good day. Bye.